This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We just heard from Dr. D. James Kennedy, whose goal is to reclaim America for Christ. My guest, Frederick Clarkson, has been following the movement to turn America into a Christian nation. He's the author of the 1997 book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Clarkson has been writing about politics and religion for about 20 years. Dr. D. James Kennedy, who we heard from earlier, is one of the many people who have pointed out that the Constitution never actually uses the words separation between church and state. And many of the people who argue that, as James Kennedy does, that they want to reclaim America for Christ, say that the Founding Fathers never intended to erect a barrier between politics and religion. The goal was to protect religion from the government, not to protect government from religion. How does that compare with your interpretation of what the Founding Fathers and the Constitution have to say about church and state?
Well, it's true that the Constitution does not have the words church and state in it. And in fact, it doesn't have the word God or Christianity in it either. In fact, the framers of the Constitution did a very revolutionary thing that belies what D. James Kennedy says. And that is that they were very specifically overthrowing 150 years of colonial theocracy, and that for the first time in the history of the world, they were creating a culture of religious equality, where your religious orientation would be irrelevant to your status as a citizen. And where we see that, in fact, the only mention of religion in the Constitution, is in Article 6, which says there'll be no religious tests for public office anywhere in the United States. And what they were specifically referring to were the various oaths, usually explicitly Christian oaths, that public officials had to take in the colonies in the previous 150 years, because you had to be a member of the correct sect, by and large, to vote and hold public office. So what Article 6 did was say, okay, well, if you can be of any religion to be a public official, you could also be of any religion to be a citizen. That was a very radical thing, and it set in motion the disestablishment of the what were then called established churches. So, for example, in Massachusetts, we had the Congregational Church, the descendant of the original Puritans in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And naturally, the powers that be in the various colonies didn't like this. They didn't want to be disempowered in that way and have religious equality.
When you said that there was a colonial theocracy, you're referring to the fact that many of the colonies had an established church?
Mm-hmm.
And what did it mean to have an established church?
Well, it meant a little bit different things in different places, but it basically meant that you had an official church that was recognized by the state and in some cases supported by the state. And what that meant was that some religions were just illegal. In the Massachusetts Bay Colony, as we know, we had the witch trials and the executions there. But what people often forget is that 40, 50 years before the Salem witch trials, which were held in the late 1600s, there were Quakers hung on Boston Common just for being Quakers. And it was illegal not only to be a Quaker, but it was even illegal to have a Quaker in your home. So the state enforcement of religious doctrines and the state enforcement, in some cases, of church membership was profound. One of the formative experiences of young James Madison in Virginia was that he was an Anglican, and his father was actually an Anglican elder. And he was horrified to see the beating and jailing of a Baptist minister merely for preaching the gospel as he understood it. And it was that experience that sent the young James Madison on to what became Princeton University to study the meaning of religious liberty. It was illegal to be a Baptist in Virginia, which, of course, would have been a problem for our modern Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who are Baptists today.
How do you interpret it when the Constitution says that the government will have no established religion?
Well, it means exactly what it says. There won't be any established churches, either federally or at the state level. The First Amendment sought to clarify the matter of religion and government, but the foundational idea is still in Article 6, And this is the stumbling block that the Christian right and the Christian nationalists can't get around, so they don't really like to talk about it. And that's the idea that religious freedom resides with the individual. And there's no mention of Christianity. So you could be a Christian or a Jew or an atheist, and you have equal standing in the Constitution and in the law in terms of citizenship. Where religion resides is with the individual and the individual conscience, and it's not up to government or established churches, which are illegal, to determine what you and I will believe or how our beliefs might evolve over time.
Those people who want to see religion play a stronger role in politics, and specifically to have Christians play a stronger role in politics and have our government more strongly reflect what they would describe as Christian values, they sometimes point to the Declaration of Independence, which doesn't talk about Christianity, but it does mention the word God. Mm-hmm. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires, etc. And then it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. So, I mean, you could really argue, as many people do, that the Declaration of Independence acknowledges God, it acknowledges religion and accepts religion as part of the basic principle upon which the United States is being created.
The Christian right's invocation of the Declaration of Independence is an act of political desperation. The difficulty that they have is, again, the Constitution and the clear, unambiguous intentions of the framers of the Constitution was to disestablish the churches and to establish the culture and the law of religious equality. The Declaration of Independence, written some 20, 25 years before the Constitution, was a political document, and it was intended to rally people to rise up against the king for a variety of reasons. And the invocation of God was a unifying rallying point. But it's of no legal or constitutional significance in terms of our legal structure. Many of the same people who drafted and signed the Declaration of Independence were also people who drafted and signed the Constitution. And they made a clear choice. They used God in their political document to revolt against the king, and they left God out of the document that founded the new nation.
My guest is Frederick Clarkson, author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frederick Clarkson. He's been writing about religion and politics for about 20 years. His writings include the 1997 book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. We just heard from Dr. D. James Kennedy, and he says his goal is to reclaim America for Christ. Where do you see him fitting in to the larger movement to bring Christian values into the government?
Well, D. James Kennedy's been an important leader of the Christian right from fairly early on, since the 1970s. But he represents a Presbyterian Reformed tradition of evangelical Christianity, unlike Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, who are Southern Baptists and fundamentalists. And his approach has been longer term and more methodical, arguably a bit more intellectual than the others. And bringing along his constituency has been on a much slower arc. So the Reclaiming America conference that he began with in 1994 was a very significant shift for him and for his constituency in beginning to engage the people of his denomination and the wider swath of conservative Presbyterianism into a more explicitly Christian political mode. They had not really been engaged as a major constituency. So Kennedy, systematically moving his empire of his congregation and his national and international television and radio ministry and his seminary and his schools more explicitly into a proactive conservative Christian stance was a major development, and it's been coming along slowly, but gaining momentum and standing as he's established Washington offices and increased his public profile considerably.
There are several groups and several different points of view that are represented within the movement that would like to see America become a more Christian nation and to see the government mm-hmm. become more Christian influenced. And I'm wondering if you would first describe what you think the far end of it, what the most extreme end of it is.
Well, sure. There's a movement that I've written quite a bit about called Christian Reconstructionism. And the leading thinker of which, the late R.J. Rushdoony, his classic work is called The Institutes of Biblical Law. And what he sought to do in that work was to say, okay, if one were to have a government that was biblical, what would that look like? What does God require for us in the way of biblical laws? And the effect of this, the analogy that I use, is if you took the U.S. Constitution and the entire history of U.S. Federal case law and compared that to the Ten Commandments, and all of the stories of judicial application of the Ten Commandments as found in the Bible, you would have the Institutes of Biblical Law. So it was really the first effort to codify what biblical law would be. And it would be an extreme form of Christian theocracy, in which, for example, there's a long list of capital offenses, mostly for sexual and religious crimes that include homosexuality and adultery, but also blasphemy and heresy, and of course, witchcraft. So we've seen elements of that here in our own history in the early colonies. These ideas, the thinkers, many of their works are in wide distribution in Christian homeschools, Christian schools, seminaries, even law schools. Reconstructionists are small in number, but the influence of their ideas and their published works is vast.
You say this movement is small. Are any members of the leadership names that are often in the news?
No. The Christian Reconstructionist movement, as they would name themselves, are a relatively small group of thinkers and scholars. Their books and their ideas are well known in conservative Christian circles, but you hardly ever see them in the news media. For example, one very popular author and speaker is a man named George Grant, who was for quite a number of years the number two at James Kennedy's Coral Ridge Ministries. He's a Christian Reconstructionist author, and his books explicitly call for the death penalty for homosexuality, for example. Another popular author is a man named Gary DeMar, who heads a little publishing house called American Vision in Atlanta. And his books are in wide use in Christian home schools all over the United States. I would imagine that the numbers of people reading his versions of American history that say that America was founded as a Christian nation number in the hundreds of thousands. But most importantly of all is R.J. Rushdoony, the seminal thinker of the movement. His book, The Institutes of Biblical Law, was used and may still be used at Pat Robertson's Regent University Law School in courses on constitutional law. Because if you're going to be a Christian lawyer, then you'd certainly first need to be able to pass the bar, but you'd also need to have some grounding in the idea of what Christian law is supposed to be all about.
You've said the significance of this Reconstructionist movement is not in the number of people who are members of it, but in its power, in the power of its ideas, and in the surprising acceptance of those ideas. Can you talk about how you think this movement, although not a well-known movement and not a particularly popular movement, has inspired political activity?
There's been a sea change in American evangelicalism in the latter part of the 20th century. And there were a lot of reasons for it. We see a lot in the news lately about Tim LaHaye and the Left Behind series and apocalypticism. That's been an emphasis in evangelical theology that's actually been in decline for quite a while. in the 70s and the 80s, we saw people like Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell constantly on their television shows predicting Armageddon and showing maps of the Middle East and predicting, trying to interpret current events in terms of what was supposed to happen in biblical prophecy. And somewhere in the early 80s, they stopped doing that. Both Falwell and Robertson and many others had come under the influence of the Christian Reconstructionist writers. And a great theological compromise had taken place, because if you believed that the world could only change after Jesus returned, and the world as it is now, being in the end times, was pretty much run by Satan, politics was kind of a waste of time. You couldn't really expect to accomplish very much, and while it was your duty as a Christian to do good things, changing the government wasn't really seen as a particularly effective thing to do. But there was another school of thought that extends beyond the Christian Reconstructionists. They're generally referred to as post-millennialists, and that's generally the idea that the world becomes more perfectly Christianized, more perfectly Christian, until Jesus can return. So it's a tremendously politically powerful idea, because it means that all of the things that you do in your life make the world a more perfectly Christian place. And if you believe, as they do, that it's your job to Christianize the government, that's a tremendously transcendent idea and takes the grunt work of politics out of the idea that you're actually building the kingdom of God.
One of the priorities of Dr. Kennedy's Center for Reclaiming America is to promote creationism. From your studies of the religious right, why do you think opposing the teaching of evolution has become so important?
The idea of creationism is it's a whole worldview. It can be synonymous with what could be called a biblical worldview from their point of view, but if you adhere to the idea of creationism, not just as in terms of the beginning of the world and the biblical account of Genesis, but as an entire worldview, then what happens is that you look at the public schools that don't teach that worldview, and certainly through science present a different idea of the beginnings of the world, there's a conflict. And many of the leaders of the Christian right will say that the public schools, if you send your children to them, you might as well be sending them to be taught by Satan or Satan's agents. And they mean it. So the fight over the teaching of evolution versus creationism in the public schools goes fundamentally to what their worldview is about.
Is there a growing homeschool movement in the Christian right?
Yes, very much. The homeschooling movement has been going on for quite a while now, several decades, and it's quite actually quite an industry. Since at least the 80s, the right to homeschool has been a part of the Republican Party platform under the influence of the Christian right. And there are many organizations that are involved in legal support. Various kinds of curriculums are out there that you can purchase. Huge textbook industry has built up around it. And there was just recently a statewide Christian homeschooling conference here in Massachusetts involving hundreds and hundreds of people. So taking one's children out of the public schools and teaching them at home is a trend, and it's a movement. And it's even advanced so far as there's actually a college in Virginia, Patrick Henry College, headed by Michael Ferris, who founded the Homeschool Legal Defense Fund. And it's a college that's intended primarily for children who've been homeschooled through all or most of their education. And it's very interesting because that college, being located so close to Washington on purpose, seeks to place its students in internships in Washington. And I'm told that there are more interns in the White House from Patrick Henry College than any other.
Frederick Clarkson, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Frederick Clarkson writes about religion and politics. He's the author of the book Eternal Hostility: The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy.